We're going into a public hearing on Senate Bill 553, and would ask staff to introduce the bill. And in the meantime, Richard Burke, if you wanted to go ahead and come on up. Or did he leave? Okay, go ahead.
Thank you, Senator. Senate Bill 553 requires that the Health Division include anti-drug messages in all of its anti-tobacco advertising and requires that programs receive division grants, which educate the public on tobacco risk, also include the illegal drug risk message in their information. As a little background, the Tobacco Prevention Education Program at Health Division consists of a number of programs and services geared at preventing tobacco use and cessation of tobacco use. For example, there's 23 school-based programs that have been funded, representing 198 school districts. The division also funds a tobacco cessation telephone line, some tribal tobacco programs, multicultural outreach, prevention, and a multitude of other programs. The division uses in its public awareness and education program various paid and earned media methods to convey key messages about tobacco use. For example, and a lot of their advertising consists of paid radio and television spots. Their 99-2001 budget for advertising is approximately $3.9 million. A good portion of this is for media placement, and then down about $1 million for professional services. Earned media is producing press releases and promotional information about interest stories for distribution to media. There is a fiscal impact statement that we just received to this, and in short, and it's attached to your summary. The Legislative Fiscal Office feels that adding anti-illegal drug use messages to the tobacco ads would substantially increase the cost of purchasing and advertising for anti-tobacco, since the Health Division utilizes a lot of prepackaged or already developed advertising that they just kind of gear towards use in Oregon. They do note that the Office of Alcohol and Drug Abuse Programs, or ODAP, has a liaison position that ties the illegal drug use and tobacco use messages together and services. However, right now they are unsure of the direct or indirect costs of implementing this bill. They're indeterminate.
Go ahead, Richard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senators, I first of all would like to apologize on behalf of Senator George, who had intended to testify as well as serve his normal committee duties. As you may know, he is ill at home in bed. I spoke with him about 35 minutes ago. So on an impromptu basis, I am filling in for him today, and I'll do my best to try and represent his positions on this bill. I believe that what he is trying to do here is point out a basic irony in our policy. And that is that we have a program like this, which is designed to fight use of a legal product, but these dollars are not going to fight an illegal product. And also, to question the general role and credibility of government programs such as these in trying to discourage use of these harmful substances, which I think all of us want to do. Some of the credibility issues are exemplified by the fact that on one hand we tell children not to use cigarettes. On the other hand, we are heavily dependent on tobacco taxes and subsidized tobacco farmers, at least at a federal level. We wonder if it wouldn't be better for these programs to exist outside the public sector, among the many known groups that are not in the public sector, which fight tobacco use and other sorts of drugs. But as long as we're going to have this program, if we're going to have the program, I think it is worth at least asking the question as to whether or not we should be dealing with other harmful substances too. Because let's face it, you've got all sorts of substances, alcohol, tobacco, marijuana, cocaine, and the differences in how we treat these drugs or substances is defined by tradition and by laws rather than their harm or their benefits. And so if we change our mindset a little bit to a mindset that says don't use harmful substances, which could include tobacco, and we work to change that mindset, it might be possible to actually save money by having a more efficient advertising campaign which speaks to that concept instead of the... I'm sorry.
I've got to gavel down to a subcommittee here. We're one under our majority, so go ahead and continue.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It would be more efficient to do it under that sort of a concept than a concept of tobacco, alcohol, drugs. And the folks that are opposing this bill were very kind, and they provided a list of some of their arguments. And I thought it might be worth speaking to it. And, you know, if the arguments hold up, that's great. If they don't, maybe it could provide some productive food for thought. One of their fears is that if they tried to put an anti-drug message in addition to the anti-tobacco message, that the message itself would be diluted. I think that this isn't necessarily true. I think it depends on how you handle it. I think if, in a traditional sense, you have a commercial that says don't use tobacco and it also says don't use drugs, you're probably right. You're probably dividing the message. But if you have somebody smoking a cigarette and you say don't use drugs, you're reinforcing two things. You're reinforcing that nicotine is a drug, and you're providing a single coherent message. So I think the diluting message issue isn't necessarily true depending on how you handle the message. Also, one of their other concerns was the money for production. Their fear is that no ads such as this exist which can be purchased. That may or may not be true. I don't know how extensive their search was and how much time they put into this. But they did state that they do buy certain advertisements and they do minor modifications, such as to point out the agency that is sponsoring it. It strikes me that they should be able to find some such advertisements where a caption could be inserted, as they're inserting captions now, which would say don't use drugs and have a picture of a cowboy smoking a cigarette or some image that appeals to what their target audience might be. Maybe this wouldn't be appropriate for every single application. It just seems to Senator George that, you know, if we're trying to discourage, if we insist on using government to discourage people from using harmful substances, that it makes sense to try and make the dollars go as far as possible. And by going on a concept of harmful substances versus a divided concept of treating alcohol differently than another substance, it could be possible to get a lot more out of our dollar than we're getting now. And that, based on my conversations with Senator George, is the position that he's trying to convey with this bill.
Okay. Question?
Gavel up to a full public hearing again.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Carter.
At some point I'd like to ask a question, but I'd like to hear the comments of the Health Division first, and so I'm...
They are coming.
Oh, okay. So I'm wondering if you're going to be sticking around, Patrick.
If you need me to, Senator, I'd be happy to.
Then I'm, if Mr. Chairman, if that's okay.
We'll go ahead then. With
it. Yeah.
All right. Thank you, Richard. I appreciate that.
Call him Patrick. Pardon me, Richard.
Oh, no, that's fine. Thank you, Senator. Thank you, Mr.
Our
Chairman.
Our colleague is under the weather today, and I wish him a speedy recovery.
Okay. I'll convey that to him. Thank
Absolutely.
You.
Absolutely.
We have John Valley from the American Cancer Society. And is it Ann?
Blaker?
Ann Blaker.
Ann Blaker, okay. Well, I thought it was that, but I was hesitant from the Department of Health Services, Oregon Health Division, Department of Human Services.
Would you like to pick them up again?
Yes, that's fine. And go ahead. I note that you have a little different message from the one we've just heard.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ann Blaker, and I'm the program manager for the Tobacco Prevention and Education Program. the Department of Human Services, which includes, in this case, the Health Division and the Office of Alcohol and Drug Abuse Prevention, actually oppose Senate Bill 553. Tobacco and illegal drug use, we're aware they're both very important problems in Oregon, and we also realize it's important that we work together to deal with these problems, especially among youth. However, Senate Bill 553 requires that an anti-illegal drug message be included in all advertisements or program components of the Tobacco Prevention and Education Program. And such an approach would, we believe, greatly decrease the effectiveness of our program. In designing a campaign and an advertising campaign or a health campaign, one of the most critical factors that you want to consider is what's your audience? Who are you going to target? And we put a lot of energy into targeting our campaigns. The most effective advertisements speak specifically and directly to that targeted audience. You wouldn't want to approach someone who is using heroin about quitting the use of heroin the same way that you would approach someone about quitting the use of tobacco. Another impact, and the staff alluded to this, another impact of this bill would be the cost implications to change our method of obtaining advertising. Currently, the Tobacco Prevention Education Program purchases advertising from other states, which has been produced and tested in those states. Sometimes we bring it here and test it here as well. But it's a very cost-effective way for us to get material that we know will be effective. And we do, as was mentioned, we do a little bit of customization. We usually add our 1-800 line, our Oregon Tobacco Quit line number on the billboards and as tailors on our, or trailers, excuse me, on our television ads. However, we really are, with that in mind, we're not at all aware of any advertising that is currently available that includes both an anti-illegal drug and an anti-tobacco message. And if Senate Bill 553 were to pass, then we would need to create that kind of advertising or campaign. I believe it would be a prohibitively expensive process. It would lead to being able to run fewer ads, actually, or pay for less time in the media if all of our money needed to go to production. So ultimately, that would decrease our effectiveness, and that's our concern. As you've probably heard before, tobacco is the number one cause of premature death and disease in this state and nationally. And in 1996, Oregon voters passed ballot Measure 44, designating 10% of the resulting tax to tobacco prevention and education, and it illustrated their understanding of the importance of reducing tobacco use. Since that time, consumption of tobacco use has dropped 23% in Oregon, in large part due to the Oregon's Tobacco Prevention and Education Program. This program has been recognized nationally for its work. We work along the lines of best practices advocated by the Centers for Disease Control. To introduce messages or curricula about illegal drug use into the Tobacco Prevention Education Program campaign would decrease its effectiveness. We believe it's important to stay the course originally plotted for us by the voters in 96 if we're going to maintain our level of success. Thank you.
Good afternoon. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to testify before this committee today. My name is John Valley, and I am the chair of the Oregon Health Leadership Against Tobacco, or OLOT, which is a group comprised of the American Heart Association, the American Lung Association, and the American Cancer Society. Today I'm here in opposition to Senate Bill 553, a bill that could potentially endanger Oregon's extremely successful tobacco prevention and cessation program. Oregon's tobacco prevention and cessation program is a national model in terms of its success. The program run by the Oregon Health Division is a comprehensive program that incorporates the Oregon Tobacco Quit Line, programs run through schools, community programs across Oregon, multicultural programs, and public education and media. Senator George's bill, while very well-intentioned, would threaten the success of Oregon's program in several ways. First, our program works extremely well because, while it is comprehensive, it is at the same time very narrowly focused on tobacco prevention. tobacco use since 1996, when Oregon's Comprehensive Tobacco Prevention and Cessation Program began, has gone way down. This is due in part to Oregon's aggressive media campaign. Each media campaign that is used is tested for its effectiveness in terms of reducing tobacco use. Were the Health Division required to add anti-drug and alcohol messages to the tobacco prevention media campaign, they would be forced to dilute their highly successful message and would be mandated to use untested messages. The effects on tobacco prevention remain largely unknown, but it would be easy to surmise that diluting the message and or having multiple messages would be likely to have a negative impact. Second, the money that is used to fund the Tobacco Prevention Cessation Program comes from Measure 44. Measure 44, a 1996 statewide initiative that had enormous voter approval, mandated that 90% of the tobacco surtax increase go to the Oregon Health Plan and 10% of the money go to tobacco prevention and cessation. There was no discussion of this money going to anti-alcohol and drug messages, only tobacco prevention and cessation programs. To use the money for any other purpose would break faith with the intent of the measure and significantly change what the voters intended. For these reasons, the American Heart Association, the American Cancer Society, and the American Lung Association, while complimenting Senator George on his well-meaning intentions, oppose Senate Bill 553 due to its potentially grave harm to Oregon's tobacco prevention and cessation program. Thank you for letting me testify, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that the committee might have.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Bisley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm curious, is there any legal ramifications from ballot measure 44 as to whether these funds could be used for something other than tobacco?
I believe the statute states that it is to go to the Oregon Health Division for the use of tobacco prevention and education.
So is there potential for a challenge, or maybe we'd need legislative counsel to?
Probably.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I could answer that question.
I'm not sure, but it probably would make sense that there could be a potential challenge to that.
Thank you.
Well, actually, Mr. Chairman, my questions were answered, because the questions that I had prepared to give to Richard all had to do with this issue, and I'll just put the questions on record, but I think it's been answered. And my questions to you, Richard, would have been, is the Senator asking that the message would be strengthened if it were added to the ongoing messages now in place for tobacco cessation and prevention? And number two would have been, has the Senator received cost analysis for the change? And that was answered through the fact that with them now using a national message, it cuts down their cost of doing business. And so to change that message obviously would cost more money, because now you're going into the production area of a new message. And I was just wondering how you considered that. And the other one is, the Senator prepared to ask for dollars to have that message added, would have been my question along these lines. Because even though we are talking about prevention education in either of these areas, to add a drug and alcohol, which is actually two messages in one, going on tobacco cessation education, I'm not sure the schools would allow the tobacco, as many people that are working with our schools now, to go in and talk with schools. So those would have been my questions that I wanted to ask and on this bill, because on the face of it all, it sounds like that makes sense. Except if you have used national media to, except if there's an association of people who put a message together, and then you'd have to use, other than the 1-800 number in your local community, you have to rewrite the message. And I'm just wondering if that is a wise use of where we're going right now. That would have been my question, Mr. Chairman. So I think under those circumstances, Mr. Chairman, my questions have been answered to both of you. But what I would, Mr. Chairman, like at some point for each of these groups to bring us up to date, and I don't know whether this is the appropriate day for that to happen, Mr. Chairman, at all, but at some point I'd like to know where we are in terms of our message and how effective the message is being, and with you stating that you have a 24% cessation rate that is going on now. I think it's pretty impressive in such a short length of time. And but I'd like to know if we are reaching and educating to the greatest degree that we can our young people, because that's those are the groups that we must even stop. You know, there must be prevention, and that's the piece I'd like to know if we are as intense as we need to be, or what do we do to gear up more to do that?
Mr. Chair, may I answer that question?
Certainly may.
Right. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I am happy to report that we have found we had a 42% drop in the use among eighth graders between the beginning of the program and our latest surveillance study. It was more than we dreamed of, frankly, and we were very, very pleased with that. We also saw a drop somewhere, I don't remember the exact figure, somewhere between 20 and 24% on 11th grade use.
Yeah.
So we've seen marked drop in youth use as well.
And if I could just add real quick to that, I think it was mentioned in the earlier testimony that if we have the anti-drug message, and nicotine is potentially a drug as well, that we sort of get a bang for our buck. I would stress that there are different drugs that we're talking about and different ways of treating those types of drugs, whether it's alcohol, cigarettes, marijuana, and that by combining them into one message may not be the most effective way. And I think I would reemphasize that it could dilute it, because I think we're treating those different drug issues in different ways, and having them all under one media advertisement could be confusing and not necessarily as effective with the results we're already seeing.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Senator Christian, may I ask a question?
Yes, sure.
Thank you. You use quite a bit of, you use earned, where you do press releases and stories and other ways to get the message out. Has the Health Division or has any of these like low cost or lower cost methods ever looked at maybe trying to include nicotine in that list of drugs is kind of see how the message might fly with the readers of it. It's a way to kind of test how this might work without having to go into a lot of dollars for it.
Well, Mr. Chair and Committee, I don't know if I can answer that really directly. I think actually the assumption has been made because there's such a difference between tobacco and other drugs and society's perception of those that hasn't really been considered. I think that we have to remember that we're dealing with two really different, we're dealing with illegal drugs and we're dealing with drugs that people see used on the street on a daily basis, and so the approaches are very different. And to group them together is very confusing, especially to youth.
Are there any studies or statistics that show how many children have a combined habit?
The dual diagnosis piece.
Yeah. Of cigarette use and...
I'm sure that there are, and I can get those figures to you. I don't have them off the top of my head.
No, I don't either, but we can get that, probably.
Another question I would have, this isn't including alcohol, or would it include alcohol into this drug? The way it's worded, or is it just strictly illegal?
Mr. Chair, I took it to mean illegal drugs.
Okay. So not just illegal from the standpoint that they were being used by a person that wasn't legal to possess them yet.
That's how we perceived it.
Yeah. That's how I perceived it, too. I just wanted to kind of find out here and get a couple of things on record. Okay. I guess... do you mind if Richard joins you?
No, not at all.
May I just ask one point, make one
certainly
point?
Because
I think with the senator's good intention, I'm wondering, because actually they should take the opportunity to toot their horn a little bit in terms of the relationship that the health department has with community-based organizations. You guys do a good job of that. So I'm wondering, since you're so effective in using the face-to-face relationship between community-based organizations, if that might not be through some rule that you have to ask the community-based organizations to make that a part of their presentation, which I think could do nothing but add at that level. I do think the cost would be a little prohibitive in terms of those dollars that you have given to media and to rechange the message, but I think the face-to-face visitations that community-based organizations make in their communities, that's a very positive message. And I'd like for each of you to speak to that and see if that is something you think could be forthcoming, to see how it works, and if it backfires, you could immediately draw back.
Want me to take it first?
Sure.
Okay. Thank you for the question, Mr. Chair. I think that's an excellent point, and we try very hard to work among all the groups, the population groups within our state. And we're more successful with some than others. Mm-hmm. But I appreciate your distinction, the distinction you made between media and what we would term outreach, mm-hmm. which is really important in this area, particularly we find with people of color. They're much more responsive to that. And then the overriding media message helps reinforce what they're getting within their community. And as you know, we have a member of ODAP staff that is in our office 2 days a week, and that's the kind of thing that we can talk about in terms of program development. And when we look into these things, then we do research across the country and we find out, you know, what's worked elsewhere. Mm-hmm. And that would be a really interesting thing to pursue.
Yeah, that would be great.
Yeah.
Me too.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think just sort of piggybacking what Ann's been talking about, obviously I think to really sort of reduce tobacco use and educate young people about the dangers of cigarette smoking and tobacco products in general, it needs to be a comprehensive approach, and I think that's one of the reasons why Oregon has been successful with its media campaign, but also with community outreach. And I think we do need to find new ways of getting the message out there, working on some of the successful programs that a lot of the county coalitions all across the state have already been doing. I know the Attorney General just this past year went all across the state and met with a lot of the county coalitions and a lot of the students who work on the tobacco prevention and education programs within their own school districts and some of the successes they had. And I think we need to learn from that. I know the Attorney General, I think, will be releasing his report and recommendations sometime early this spring, and use that approach. I think there's a lot of different things we can do. We know that they are successful. It's just a matter of being able to fund those programs and fully develop and implement them.
I'd like to speak to some of the premises now. First of all, I'd like to point out that this is the nicest opposition that I've ever dealt with. And also, you folks have been wonderful too. But it's my job to defend this bill. And there are some questions that I think do need to be asked. First of all, I don't think, although the apparent success of the plan is very admirable, I think we have to ask some more questions if we're going to evaluate it. For example, execution of their campaigns have been perhaps one factor. Another factor could have been the increased cigarette taxes, which were designed in part to discourage purchasing, particularly by minors. There's also the bad public relations regarding the tobacco lawsuits, which dominated news for a long time and may well have done a lot. Also, there may be changes in adolescent fashion. Perhaps marijuana became fashionable and kids started using that instead of cigarettes, and maybe in 5 years they'll go back. I think if you're going to evaluate a program and take it and say that we can't change it because it's successful, and if we mess with it, we're going to ruin it, I think you've got to really examine the apparent success and find out if that's what the cause was. They've said that they couldn't find a way to use existing advertisements and caption them in a way which would combine messages. But I'd really like to know what kind of a search has been done. I don't think this is a logistical issue. I think this is a creativity issue. And they've worked very hard and they've come up with a lot of creativity solutions. And I think if we look at it, it may be possible to come up with a solution which at least implies an anti-drug message. And I think it's just a question of looking for it. And I'm thinking to myself, it may be possible to strike a compromise with an amendment on this bill. One amendment that I could suggest would be perhaps to sunset this so that they can try it. They can see what they can do. And if it doesn't work, if it can be demonstrated it doesn't work, it goes away. And we go back to what we were doing before. But these things are so important that I think we have to really look at them closely, and including the reasons behind the apparent decline in smoking and the value of putting together an anti-drug message. As far as the legal ramifications are concerned, I think that's an excellent question. I think as long as it is clear that use of nicotine is discouraged, I would be surprised if anyone would be politically motivated to argue against an anti-drug message. I certainly wouldn't want to make that argument. But I agree with what they said, that it would probably have to be something answered by legal counsel. Anyhow, those were some points I wanted to make, and just maybe offer an idea, and I hope that's of some assistance.
Do you have any idea on the question of how many might be users of both, or is tobacco considered an entry-level drug to illegal drug usage through the art of smoking? Or
well, from my experience in high schools, which is limited, but there's some. I was on the local school committee, Beaverton High School. I've had teacher training. I've been in high schools. I think it's actually easier for a lot of teens to get marijuana than it is to get cigarettes. And so if there is a gateway, if there is such a thing as a gateway, I don't think it's tobacco.
You know, I think what we need to do, I think we need to get a little more information and find out really what combination this is, because I think there's a tendency sometimes to, if you're not reaching and targeting a direct audience, there's a tendency for someone to say, well, you know, that really doesn't concern me. I would never do that. I might do something else, but I'd never do that. And they might turn off and miss the whole message. I don't think we ought to purposely overlook an opportunity. And perhaps we need to pursue this more to see about community presentations and things like that that are not necessarily canned, purchased productions and advertisements and things like that, and maybe pursue it from that angle a little more than to try to include too much in on the mass media, or however you want to put it. I'm not sure exactly I'm using the right terms, because I'm not an advertising agent. That became very apparent to me when I started to run in the political circle. I needed considerable help.
I'm learning a lot myself. Mr. Chair, can I comment to that?
Certainly.
Well, one of the things that was stated, I do want to let you know that our program report is out now, our 2001 program report, and we can make those available to you. One of the things you'll find in the program report is we compare the consumption rate in Oregon, and that dropped to other states in the country, and we are dropping at twice the rate, because we are also very concerned about trying to figure out if it's the program that's having the impact, or is it, you know, what's going on in the outer world. It's in reality a combination of everything, but we do believe that the program has accelerated the decline dramatically in Oregon, both among youth and adults. And also I want to make the point that when we talk about media, we're talking about paid media and earned media, and they are both important. And so, you know, a good part of our campaign is paid media, and it's the most visible part of our campaign, but it in reality supports everything that we're doing. And the third thing is, I really do believe that you confuse people, especially youth, when you start talking about mixed messages and drug messages, especially, and behavior messages.
And if I could just piggyback on something that Ann was talking about, Mr. Chair and the committee members, one of the comments that was just made as far as figuring out exactly what it is that potentially is reducing the cigarette use, it's a common question that we in the tobacco control community get. Well, you know, is it the advertising, or is it that particular program, or what is it that's making this happen? And unfortunately, the real answer is there isn't one thing that we can single out that really is the most successful. It's a comprehensive program. A lot of states across the country have tried different things. Up in Washington, there was a single approach, sort of like a just say no type of campaign that actually didn't show any sort of reduction in smoking use among teens. We feel that one of the reasons Oregon is so successful is because there's a lot of different things that we address in the program. It's based on the Centers for Disease Control model that have looked at all the different ways of dealing with tobacco prevention education. We're, I think, one of the four leading states in the country that has this type of comprehensive program. So the concern is that if we look for the one media message or the one program that really is successful in reducing tobacco use, I don't think we'll ever find that. I think what we really want to emphasize, at least from the members of OLOT, is that Oregon is, in a sense, unique because we do have a comprehensive program. The media part is extremely important, but it's not the only part that is, and you can't single one part of it out. And the other comment I'd like to make as far as the mixed messages thing again, for example, I know there's been a big push with the Oregon Quit Line to be part of a lot of the paid advertisements and the billboards. One concern would be if we throw some anti-drug messages up there, if people call that, or are they thinking that they're going to get support for quitting marijuana or other types of illicit drugs because it's combined on that billboard with the Oregon Quit Line, which is just for tobacco cessation. So that would be something I'd like to just look, because I know that's been a big push lately, and that could create some more confusion. Thank you.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to support that we get more information. In my past life, I was in the cattle business, and I served with the Oregon Beef Council, which was the marketing part of the industry. And the first thing I learned is that we as farmers, or in this case, we as legislators, are not advertising specialists and pros, and it's a very different field. And for instance, sometime when you're trying to send out a positive message, you can literally be sending out a negative message and not even realizing it. So I would like to, if we're going to pursue with this bill, hear from some advertising people, the production people, and really see what impact that message might have.
A humorous advertising experience early on in my business career. My predecessor had a rather large ad in the Yellow Pages, and I just continued it because I wasn't familiar with advertising, and had it in there for about 4 years, and I began to question it. The price went up and up and up, and so I was looking for ways to cut costs. And so one day I talked to the Yellow Pages advertiser and told him I was cutting back just to a mention. And they're, oh my, you're losing your position, blah, 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 and all this. And I said, well, look, in 5 years, the only one time I've had anybody mention the Yellow Pages was a college friend of mine that came by, and he said, I looked in the Yellow Pages because I wasn't sure what your address was down here. And he said, I knew you were a big guy, and he said, I looked and I found the biggest ad and thought that must be you. And basically, that was the only good I was getting out of my ad for 5 years. And, you know, I came to the realization if I didn't have the doctors on my side, I wasn't going to be very successful in a small town having people come to my nursing home. So advertising can, in some ways, be a rather tricky type of a situation. And I don't know, would the committee be interested in perhaps having some people with a little ad specialty come and talk to us on this? Maybe we could get some of their ideas on it. And I don't know, I'm sitting here scrounging because I don't run in those circles, and I don't know who we could call. Maybe the staff can look, and maybe you folks would have some ideas.
Yeah.
Of.
We do. We have some folks who specialize on both sides of this. So.
Yes.
I just had a very brief comment. I wanted to make it very clear that the questions that I asked regarding the message were not meant to besmirch the efforts that you folks are making. You know, I think that anyone that's trying to discourage use is to be applauded, and I certainly applaud them very much. I just meant to make the point that if one of the arguments is to be this message works, don't mess with it, we have to truly establish that it is the message that is working. But I just didn't want anyone to regard my comments as being negative to what you're doing.
I think there's good concern, and I for one, I don't like to overlook any opportunity that we might have in making our money go as far as we possibly can, and making our efforts go as far as we possibly can, because, you know, we looked at this 2 years ago, and we were very impressed with what was being done in this arena, and it also causes you to think, you know, how much more money can I bury into this now and continue to get those same high production results, or are we going to taper off and now we're going to have to spend tons and tons of money just to get one or two? You know, have we blitzed the market and got all the easy ones? And again, to get back to the political arena, you know, we have kind of a rating of 1 to 5, and we don't spend much time on the fives because we know they're not going to vote for us any way, shape, or form. And the ones we're not spending much time on because they wouldn't vote for anybody else. And so you concentrate there in that middle ground. And as I said, most of us aren't terribly experienced in this kind of a way of reading that. So let's plan to put this back on the agenda sometime here in the near future and see if we can get a little more information on that. I thank you very much for coming today. And
Thank you.
Wish Senator George a quick healing.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes,
Before you go to the next agenda, I would like to have the opportunity of introducing my guests today.
I'd be delighted to have you do that. I've seen them around several times, but
yes,
you went right past me and didn't introduce me to them.
Mr. Chairman, I am so sorry. I have some very, very wonderful young people and very special guests that will start being interns in my office. This is the first day. They're students from the Portland Street Academy, which is a school that I run in my agency at the Urban League of Portland. And they are Colo Elysia, James McIver, and Denise Robinson that is sitting in the back there. So I'm very proud of these young people. For many of them, this is their, they came the first time when at the beginning of the legislature. This is their second time. Many of these kids would never hardly leave Northeast Portland. And so this is an opportunity for them, but it's also an opportunity for us too, because I was so tempted to ask them in terms of tobacco cessation and that kind of stuff. So one day I want them to be able to come and even test.
Maybe after they've been here a few times, we wouldn't want to put them on the spot.
No, we wouldn't want to put them on the spot today. That's right.
Well, welcome, and we're glad to have you here. And now you've just heard a very good bit of very pointed advertisement here, Senator Carter. Thank you very much. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 553, and we're going to open an informational meeting. We've asked Jeffrey Tyrens, the Executive Director of Oregon Progress Board, to come and give us social supports benchmarks here. And he said he could tailor his meeting for long or short, so maybe he could do something in between here.
What, Senator?
I said maybe you can have something in between,
okay,
short and long.
Right here.
Right ahead.
Okay.
As soon as you feel comfortable to start.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record.
Chair? Yes.
Excuse me, Jeffrey. Could you ask the lights be dimmed a little bit so we can
see
a little better? I think staff can do it.
It's the other dimmer. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jeffrey Tryons. I'm Executive Director of the Oregon Progress Board. I want to thank the committee very much for giving me the opportunity to appear this afternoon. What I'd like to do is to just take you through all of the benchmarks and the most recent information we have on them that relate to your committee. So we'll be looking at social supports benchmarks. I am not going to do any explanatory information about what the Progress Board is or what the benchmarks are, because I know you're all very familiar with that. So let me just move right into where we are with the benchmarks that relate in this area. They're all in the what we call the social support area, and so we'll start looking at health-related, and this will include a look at the teen pregnancy rate, a look at prenatal care, infant mortality, immunizations, HIV, adult non-smokers, premature mortality, health status, and then we throw in a couple of child care measures at the end. So we'll look at health first. One of the pieces of very positive news in Oregon is that the teen pregnancy rate has dropped now for 5 years in a row. This mirrors what's happening at the national level, but we have almost, in fact, achieved the target that we set out for ourselves back in 1996 with the benchmarks. And if the trend continues to go as it has, we will be right where we hoped we would be in the year 2000. We don't have the data in for that yet, but you can see that's a good steady trend with that number falling every year.
Yes. Just a quick question. What would you, could you give us a number for 95 and a number for 99?
Sure. Mr. Chair, Senator Shields, the rate in 1995 was about 19.3, I think, per...
I'm talking about raw number. Of
the absolute number of pregnancies? Gosh.
Even if you have to somewhat guess, I've seen this mm-hmm. this graph before, and mm-hmm. I just have always wondered, are we talking about 2,000, 5,000, 10,000? What are we talking about?
Yeah, you know, is there anybody in the audience who knows the answer to that question? I don't, but I have. We have it in the report that is almost at the printer. It will actually have the absolute number in there, but I would be happy to let you know what it is. It's in the thousands. It's not in the tens of thousands. I think, gosh, it would really be a wild guess, but I think it's like 6,000.
So you may have moved from 6,000 to 5,500 or something like that?
Yeah, to maybe 6 to maybe 4,500 or something.
Cool.
But that's a guess. I mean, that's really, that's a wild guess.
That is not then excluded. That is including abortions.
Mr. Chair, the teen pregnancy rate is both live births and abortions that occur. Once a teen is pregnant, whatever happens with that, they still are counted as a teen pregnancy. It's not the birth rate. It's the pregnancy rate.
Okay.
And I would be happy to get you those specific numbers, Senator. I have them at my office.
Well, we actually have a growing population during that period of time, too, so...
Well, we do, but so the numbers would not be as small as they would have been statically, but the amount that population has grown, I don't think it's been as high as on either side. We sort of had the boom, and then one of the cohorts went down a little bit, and then we go back up again. So it'd be very easy for me to get the absolute numbers for you, though. That would be the best instead of me making these guesses, which I really right. just...
Well, what I mean, it would still show, not maybe necessarily affect the trend per thousand, but overall yeah. it would show that even if it's a harder job, the more you have...
Right. Yes.
And the rate is down. And
so yes, no question about it, Senator.
That's definitely a good trend.
Yes. One of the areas that we've made slow progress in through most of the 1990s is the percentage of pregnant women who get adequate prenatal care, which means 3 visits to the doctor in the first trimester. So as you can see, we saw a little improvement between 1998 and 1999. We don't have the numbers yet for last year. But that is one where we set a target originally of having 95% during the early days. We went out, we did some research on it. We said the best states have 90%, so we'll set that as the target. And we've really made very little progress in achieving the 90% level. One of the reasons why the governor introduced the children's agenda was because we have not done well on getting women adequate prenatal care. One of the most effective ways to make that happen is home visitations. So the Healthy Start model is one way to improve this rate. Similarly, for the immunization rate, which was another area that we put a lot of emphasis on in the early 1990s, was to get all of our youngsters adequately immunized by age 2. As you can see, we are virtually where we were in 1995 and have seen some ups and downs. But these two early childhood indicators are probably the two that that I would say are really stick out for me as areas where we've put a lot of emphasis on and have made little real progress in terms of results. On the other hand, our infant mortality rate has come down some. We saw a little increase in that in 1999, but we've seen a pretty steady reduction from about 8 infant mortalities per 1,000 in 1990 to 6 in 1999. So that's a reduction of nearly 20%. Annual percentage of new HIV cases with early diagnosis. That is, are we finding these early? Are we getting them when we can still do the most effective treatment? We're right between 70% and 80%. When this was really a hot issue, if you will, it went up to 80%. It's dropped down to just above 70 now, primarily because these cases are harder for us to find. So this is, once again, we're way under the target of where we wanted to be, which was in the mid-80s that we wanted to be finding. But when you ask the Health Division, their answer is, as the case numbers have fallen and the people who have HIV are much harder for us to find out because they're much more spread out within the population.
Well, let me ask you a question. Are these even realistic targets from the standpoint that this is not something that has any kind of immediate feeling? You don't all of a sudden start vomiting or running a temperature, that kind of thing, so you're not going to pick this up, and probably not everybody's just going to come around and say, oh, I'm going to run myself here through for a every 6 month test. So how do you ever propose? I'm guessing that many of these people, until they have some type of a secondary situation or a primary situation, they have no idea they even should go get a checkup.
Mr. Chair, when most HIV was in certain sets of the population, you could target a message, as you were saying earlier with cigarette. You know, you need to come in. You need to have a blood test. As the cases have become harder and harder to find, as they're more spread out within the population, it's harder to get the message out to get people in. In terms of how the progress board set the target, as in almost all of these, we got expert opinion on if Oregon was going to be ambitious about what we were going to be able to screen, who, you know, how we were going to be able to do outreach, but realistic. That's the standard. Ambitious but realistic. Where should we be in 4 years, which is when these targets were set back in 1996? So we got people in who said we ought to be able to do more than 80%, and so the expert opinion was that we ought to be able to up that number. What the Health Division has found was that it was harder than they thought it was going to be.
Well, I guess I'm a little nonplussed here at that anyway, because what are you going to do, just run everybody through like a testing mill? I mean, we have mandatory inoculations, and that ought to be something real easy to, to keep track of. I mean, generally speaking, you at least got a baby in the hospital.
Right, the immunization rates, exactly.
And yet our immunization rates don't show a great lot of attention to detail here in some of these instances, let alone how you're going to start dragging people in to test them. So well, my feeling is that some having a target like that's totally unreasonable. I mean, unless you expect us to pass a law, which I don't see any light in passing myself, that would demand that everybody go get a test once you hear something like that. I mean, like a chest X-ray or
yes,
something like this, like we used to do with for tuberculosis.
Mr. Chair, the board has no intention of recommending that this become mandatory, but as you can see from the chart, back in 93 and 95, we were at or around 80%. So Oregon has been where we set the target for, and I think the board felt like if that was possible, if we were able to get to that level, that we shouldn't fall much further under the rate than we had actually achieved back in the early 1990s.
Mr. Chair. But this recognizes is a it doesn't necessarily mean that you have the same amount of diagnoses. I mean, are you culling them out? Are we having less volume of people involved in this, or are we still getting the same volume of people without the early detection?
Mr. Chair, as I understand it, and it's important to understand that we're still finding over 70% of the cases now, even with this lower level, that the absolute number of new cases has fallen through the late 1990s. So we have fewer that we're actually finding, but the percent we're finding early, which is what the public health folks say we need to do. We need to get people early rather than when they have late HIV or full-blown AIDS, has fallen a bit. But once again, it's not that far under where we were in 1993.
Senator Mesrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious, Jeffrey, why 1991? There's a lack of data there.
Mr. Chair, Senator Messerly, we just don't have the data for that year, and I don't know why we don't have it. It was not reported from the Health Division. In terms of the adults who don't currently smoke, you will see that these numbers don't look exactly like the numbers you heard about a little while earlier in terms of smoking rates. As I understand it, the statistics you received earlier had to do with tobacco consumption. These numbers actually measure the percentage of Oregonians who smoke. So if you smoke at all, you make this, percentage of Oregonians who do not smoke. So if you smoke at all, then you don't come into this percentage. If you cut way back, then the consumption that you do would go down, but you'd still be a smoker. So what we show here is that we've seen some progress since 1996. We were at about 76% of all Oregonians did not smoke then, and we're up to 79% now. But not as dramatic numbers as we saw with the with what the health division reported earlier in terms of the amount of tobacco that's actually consumed within the state.
Do we have a chance of that graph rising fairly rapidly in a next 4 or 5 years, as was testified here, that we've had some fairly successful campaigns to stop kids from smoking early? And as they, because this says adults,
right,
as these people reach adult age, it looked to me like we have a potential with the efforts that we're doing now, maybe to have see that graph rise. I mean, I could see where this down in 2010 might be very, very approachable.
Mr. Chair, my understanding is that when we get the 2000 numbers out, we will, when they're released yet and they haven't been, we'll be able to break the 80% number. And as you'll see when we look at the teen smoking slide later on, we have seen a dramatic reduction in the percentage of teens who smoke. So I think you're exactly right. We should expect them to age into this older level not smoking, because as we all know, almost everybody starts when they're young, and if they're not smoking when they're 25, they have a very low chance, if they're not prior smokers, of starting up.
Well, that's good news.
Yes. We have some interesting numbers on the overall health of Oregonians. What we find if we look at what we call the premature mortality, which is a statistic that comes out of public health, which says everybody who should die prior to the age of 70 each year is added as a year what's called of potential life lost. We see that we've actually improved those numbers. We've seen a steady lengthening of life in Oregon for people who are reaching the age of 70. That's both a reduction in illnesses and a reduction in fatalities caused by accidents. But if you ask Oregonians how healthy they think they are, which we do in Oregon, you'll see that we've We've dropped since 1993, when we started to track this, by about 10%. So we went from about 63% of Oregonians viewing themselves as healthy, as having health status of very good or excellent, to down to about 56%. So it hasn't. It's been more like a 7% reduction. But we've seen a fall in that number, a steady fall in that number over the years. Switching to child care.
State of hypochondriacs.
Mr. Chair, I don't have any relative comparisons with other states to know whether this is happening within the rest of the country or not, but it is. We've got almost half of all Oregonians who don't view their health status as either very good or excellent. I think part of that has to do with the increase in people being overweight, because that's not viewed as being healthy, I think. So I mean, these are steady. This is a steady trend. This isn't numbers that sort of leap all around. We've seen a steady reduction in that number now. For
does that correspond with our age going
yeah,
up?
Yeah, baby boomers. It's baby boomers.
It's the aches and pains of baby boomers. Is that it, Senator?
That's it.
That may well be. Switching to child care, we can see that our child care affordability, that is the percentage of families who pay less than 10% of their income on child care, has gone down a bit over the years. It's right at about 67%, or about a third of all families who pay more than that. It hasn't increased as much as you would imagine with the way other costs have increased within Oregon over the time, but it has increased a bit. We have improved the number of child care slots quite a lot, and in fact are right at where we want to be in terms of having enough child care slots statewide for the numbers that the Employment Department thought we would need and to achieve this, which is in fact a national standard. Next category, looking at benchmarks which relate to protection. Here's the number for alcohol, tobacco, and drug use among teens. The black column is alcohol use. The gray column is drug use. The white column is cigarette use. You can see that since 1996, we've seen a steady drop in all three of those areas. Now, you will notice that they're all at or about where they were in 1990. So we've gotten back to kind of where we were in 1990. We saw a pretty dramatic run-up during the mid-1990s in all of these areas, but we are at or under, for all three of these, the target that we'd set for ourselves for last year. So that is a real improvement. This is real, meaningful change, and these numbers have come down pretty significantly for eighth graders. Now, it still means that almost a third of all eighth graders had a drink in the prior 30 days. That's still an awful lot of kids that we're looking at. Well, actually, I'm sorry, it's more like one in four, but about 25% of eighth graders said, yes, I have used alcohol within 30 days prior. And that's still that's a lot of eighth graders. Our child abuse numbers are a little contradictory. We've seen a continued run-up in the child abuse rate per thousand, but most of that is children who are at risk of abuse, not actually being abused. We track both at risk and actual abuse, and you can see the dark part of the column here is actual abuse, and those numbers have come down pretty steadily since 1992, whereas the at-risk numbers, the kids who could be abused, who the state fines and either monitors or acts on in some way, has increased dramatically. Now, you could interpret that as good news, which means we're doing a better job of going out and finding these kids before they're abused, or you could view it as, well, we've got a lot more kids who are in families who might be abused than we used to. And I think it's a little bit of a combination of the two, because as you know, we added staff back in 1997, as I recall, to do more child abuse investigation. And that by itself, like having more cops on the street, means that you find more of what you're looking for. So we have, I think, a combination of those two things acting. Elder abuse,
Jeff, on
Mr.
That,
Chair.
How come you don't have a bifurcated target? We don't know whether this was all abuse or how you show abuse at risk going up and abuse coming way down.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
But the targets don't show us what to expect.
The new benchmark will be split like this. The old one wasn't. At the recommendation of the Office for Services, Children and Families, they asked the board to split it, and we will have a new target which will be split as well. Reported elder abuse has gone up pretty steadily since 1995 when we started reporting it. This is for a variety of reasons. I think people were not aware of elder abuse for a long time. We've also, by statute, added financial elder abuse as one of the things that's reported now. So we have seen a steady increase in that number, although it did slow down a little bit between 1998 and 1999. We don't have the data yet for last year.
Why would you target something up like this that you would expect it to go higher?
Why is the 2000 higher than the...
I would think we'd have a target that we would want to reduce this thing.
Mr. Chair, the board sets the target. I honestly do not know why it's a little bit higher, but we set the targets on the basis of expert opinion, and for some reason, maybe it's because of the financial reporting, I'm not sure what, that they thought that number was probably going to go up over time. As you can see, we're not even headed the right way for achieving the target right now.
Or Jeff, Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Or Jeff, it could be that you have a high expectation in terms of the target group you want to work with, and this is not the targeted rate going up higher, but rather your commitment to accomplish this goal of working with more communities.
Mr. Chair,
go into a subcommittee here.
I didn't leave.
I know I need to step out momentarily. I have a constituent here. I apologize. So I'll be right back.
Jeff.
Senator Carter, that may be the case. I'd have to go back and look and see why I have that higher number. It's a very good question, and I'm not sure right now. So okay. I will check on it and get back to the committee with that answer. In terms of alcohol and tobacco use of women who are pregnant, this is self-reported information, but we have seen a steady drop as awareness of these issues has increased. We've seen a steady reduction in the percentage of women who smoke, although it's still much, much higher than the percentage of women who use alcohol.
So, Jeff, when they're measuring, when the health division measure or ask the question in terms of the numbers of pregnant mothers who use in tobacco in particular on this map. I'm wondering if not only as if it's willful information that they give, but if also the data is collected and is more research oriented in terms of hospitals asking.
Senator, this number comes from hospitals. Is my understanding. This isn't a randomized survey that we do. So people are asked this late in their term, not early on.
Okay.
That's where it comes from. Let's move on now and look at issues that relate to poverty. The poverty rate in Oregon during the 1990s really has hovered at around 11% of all Oregonians had incomes or lived in households with incomes that were under the poverty level. We're a little skeptical of the 1994 number. We think that's probably a little high, and the fact that we saw a reduction last year when we reported it out, it may be a little low, but it's around 11%. It hasn't gone up much. It hasn't gone down a lot. Oregon is sort of in the middle of the pack when it comes to poverty. The census numbers show us at just a little under the middle state. We'll get new numbers for this when the census releases all of its numbers this spring, so we'll have a much better sense of how poverty has changed since 1990 and 00.
Question, Madam Chair?
Senator Masaryk.
Thank you, Madam Chair. How does this relate between urban and rural? Or do you see pockets where it's a much higher percentage than others?
Mr. Chair, Senator Messerly, rural poverty is generally higher than urban in Oregon. Certainly there are urban pockets of high levels of poverty, but generally at the county level, which is what we see it at, rural counties are generally poorer than urban counties.
And what is that range when you're in some of those rural counties?
Madam Chair, Senator Messerly, I think it's probably as high as 18%, 19%, but that's 90 census numbers. We don't have any county level numbers since 1990. Now, we have seen incomes have increased pretty dramatically in Oregon in the mid-1990s, but most of that's happened in urban counties. So I suspect we'll still see a pretty wide range. I actually have those numbers for all the counties if you'd like to see them.
I would.
Okay.
Thank you.
Senator Shields?
We've seen these charts in the Ways and Means sub for Human Services.
Okay.
Nobody seems to have an answer as to why the poverty rate comes down, and yet we're now listed by the Department of Agriculture, USDA, as having the highest hunger rates and the highest...
In the nation.
In the nation, right. And the highest food insecurity rates. What's the deal?
Madam Chair, Senator Shields, this is an issue I've been involved in for some time now.
This is a softball. You got a good answer.
No, it's not. It's not a softball because I don't have a final answer. We've actually gotten the Department of Housing and Community Services to put up some money to hire a researcher to compare the various rankings that Oregon has for hunger, because we asked the hunger question in the same survey we come up with the poverty numbers, because quite frankly, when the USDA came out and ranked us highest in hunger and sixth worst in food insecurity, which means you don't
fourth.
Have...
Fourth.
Sixth.
Was it six? Okay.
Yes.
I thought it was.
Sorry,
yes, it was.
Jeff, let me just take a few minutes right now to gavel us back into a public hearing. Thank you,
Madam Chair. I looked at those numbers and I could not accept the fact that we had the highest hunger rate in the United States, especially since the poverty rate is in the middle. And if you look at all the data for all the states except for Washington and Oregon, if you're high in hunger, you're high in poverty. If you're low in hunger, you're low in poverty. And Oregon and Washington are middling in poverty and right at the bottom of the barrel in terms of hunger. That is worst. And it just didn't add up. So if I could just finish the answer. So we've been trying to understand, one, comparing the survey instruments to see whether there was some sort of one of them is more biased than the other towards the respondents we get. The Oregon Population Survey is a phone survey, so we don't get the poorest of the poor who don't have a phone. The census, on the other hand, which is the data that the USDA uses, is only a very small sample of households.
But door-to-door.
Well, yes, but it's door-to-door. So we have a big sample, but we don't get that lowest level. They have a tiny sample, but they do a much more thorough job with the people that they ask. So we're hooked up with USDA right now, and we have a researcher on board who is going to try to help us answer why the differences. Because it is, you hear it everywhere. Everywhere I go, I hear this, you know, Oregon has the worst rank on hunger in the United States. Looking at all the other statistics we have, I have a little trouble really thinking that is true. But there is one explanation, if I could just, this is my last sentence on this. The one logical thing that I've heard is that the rapid run-up in housing costs in Oregon is one of the places where people choose.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm going to keep my housing and it's going to go up, then I'm going to cut back on my food. So it may be that's part of what's driving it. But these numbers, your very first question, why don't these match up, is exactly what started me on the path to try and figure out why.
Madam Chair, follow up. my point in asking that is that, yeah, like you, I hear people saying, it's housing, housing costs. So my follow-up question is, have you looked at other states where they have lower poverty? Do those have lower housing costs?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
As compared to Oregon?
Mm-hmm.
That's one question. And the other question is a much more selfish one, in a sense. When those reports came out, the Department of Human Services really got kind of, I thought, uptight.
Mm-hmm.
And the director of DHS and Adult and Family Services and so on started challenging the tool.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, it's not important whether we're first or tenth or what we are, challenging the tool isn't significant. It's hunger that's the important issue. And so if you've gone to the expense of working with Housing and Community Services to hire somebody, is this that you're hoping for a predetermined outcome that justifies us, or is this, are you really striving to make this a really objective follow-up, or is this an ego-oriented thing, or is this really to get at some facts? Excuse me for asking, it's so harsh.
Madam Chair, Senator Shields. Well, I'd look a little foolish this year and say it was an ego-driven thing, I am working with the Hunger Task Force, which has been organized by the Department of Housing and Community Services to oversee the hunger relief efforts, and they are, your voice is well represented on that group, which is, you know, we don't care if, I met with them 2 months ago, and we went over this, and we went over the study we wanted to do, and we clearly need to have good data. I mean, we need to know what it is we know and what it is we don't know. But we also need to acknowledge, as the governor says, that even if we're in the middle on hunger, it's still an important issue for us in Oregon, and we need to deal with it. So I'd like to, from my own professional viewpoint of, I'm the guy who walks around with these numbers all the time and has to stand up and say, this is where Oregon is. I want to know where we are and how to explain the variations, because the population survey shows us at a much lower level of hunger than the USDA shows. As I said, we ask a lot of those same questions. So, you know, there is an issue here of what's the right answer. But hunger is prevalent in Oregon. Food banks are not able to meet the demand. It is a policy issue for us, whether we are 6th or 12th or 18th.
I am on the board of the Hunger Relief Task Force, but I'm also on the board of a local food bank.
Mm-hmm.
And our demands in the last couple of years have doubled.
Mm-hmm.
This is in Southeast Portland, and it's similarly true for the largest food bank in the state now, which is out in mid-Multnomah County. It's Snowcap.
Mm-hmm.
Theirs is doubled.
It's true in Northeast Portland.
Yeah, everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And when I mentioned ego before, it's just that when I see DHR and AFS challenging the statistics, it was kind of like, by golly, we're going to get out of this number one category if we got to cook the figures, you know. And that's why I'm saying I really want accurate data, no matter if mm-hmm. it makes us look even worse than we are now.
Madam Chair, Senator Shields, I the day you catch me trying to cook the data is the day you should just fire me, because if my credibility with the numbers isn't there, then I don't have a job here. So I mean, I am trying to get the best numbers we can get without making little of the fact that we have a hunger issue.
Well,
and
thank you. I just really am concerned about this.
Now, Jeff, let's go back to your middle number, 94.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and this is statewide data, right?
This is the Oregon Population Survey results. Yes, ma'am.
Okay. The reason I'm asking that is because my rural colleagues have had, I think, a legitimate series of questions for a long time in terms of high unemployment, high incidences of employment loss, and also in 1994, I remember that between 79 and 82, we lost 79,400 feet of lumber in this state. And we start feeling it real badly about 1985, mm-hmm. because we saw all of these guys that were used to working in the forest products area losing jobs. Mm-hmm. So we had a high incidence of unemployment in rural areas and high incidence of unemployment in north, northeast Portland and in outer southeast Portland. Mm-hmm. Poor whites, poor black families is what you were seeing. And by 1994, I suggest to you that that number is right, because there were high incidences of unemployment and poverty in Oregon during that time, even though we don't like to talk about it. And even though you were not around at that time, I have to tell you, I believe that statistic.
Madam Chair, thank you for letting me off the hook on that. The only reason I said that was because this was a survey that was done by another firm,
right.
And we had some methodological issues about the way poverty was calculated, and we never were really able to nail down the fact that, yes, this is as right as we can get. It wasn't 9%, mm-hmm. but it may not have been quite as high as 15.
Right. I think if you go back to economic forecast and being the banker and the farmer and all the kind of stuff that you are, I bet that when you listen to many rural legislators represent what was going on in rural Oregon, and listen to somebody like me who came from the urbanmost mm-hmm. district in this state, mm-hmm. you would hear, because we were in double digit, like 27% to 32% unemployment in northeast Portland and 94. So I think that you're looking at some true mm-hmm. data. And I'm back to Senator Shields' point of view, not you, the statistician or the poorest person that go and report the benchmarks, but how do we get people to actually respond to the issue as an issue? Mm-hmm. Is the issue factual, or is it some data that disproves where we truly are?
Mm-hmm.
And what we're looking for are the facts. If we have hungry people in Oregon, then by George, we don't want you trying to change, not you, we don't want the numbers changed to make us look good. Mm-hmm. We want people fed so we can feel good and look good. And that becomes the issue.
Madam Chair, I couldn't agree more. I mean, one of the interesting things about Oregon's economy is that we seem to, no matter how good the economy is, and if you ask John Mitchell could the economy get any better in, 1997 or 1998, he would have said no. You know, the economy's going, well, maybe not 1997, 1998, because that was the Asian flu, but mm-hmm. but during the 90s, we've had generally a very good economy, mm-hmm. and yet we can't seem to get our poverty rate down below about 11%. There are states in this United States that have poverty rates of 8%. That are substantially lower than Oregon's, and if you look back over the years, if you look at all the census data, which goes back for say 40 years, Oregon's poverty rate has never gotten down under around 11%, and it's sort of a funny thing about the economy that it does not, it kind of hits a floor, and then that's as low as it goes, regardless of how hot the economy is.
Off the record, one of these days, I have a ventured thought about that, about why that is. Because when we changed from a wood products industry, we went to a high-tech industry, what you did was left so many people behind, because we were looking at what was happening in our educational system, people not being able to transition into a high technology arena, mm-hmm. and you still had high incidences of unemployment, because we were building an economy that basically had nothing to do with the skills of people that we had in the state.
Mm-hmm.
They've asked for help.
Go on, John.
Madam Chair, let me move on here just very quickly. We've seen a substantial reduction, as you're all very aware, of the percentage of Oregonians who lack health insurance. So we've actually made a little improvement even between 1998 and last year, which surprised me, because I thought we would have been pretty flat in light of what's happened with the Oregon Health Plan and in light of what's happened with the economy. But we got down to about 10% of all Oregonians, and this is another urban-rural issue. If you look at the Portland metropolitan area, you'll see that about 95% of all Oregonians have health insurance. When you get out to the eastern part of the state, that number is more like about 83% or so. So there's a pretty wide gap between parts of the state in terms of people who have insurance.
See, I'm a naysayer. I don't believe that statistic. I think it's higher than that. I'm where you guys on the other side are trying to find out is it true. And I'm saying it's not true because I think it's higher than that. But move on.
Higher, Madam Chair? You mean there are more people who have insurance or more people without insurance?
I think that there are more people without health insurance.
Without.
That's exactly right.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
Madam Chairman, I would agree, and I think it could get worse as the cost of the Oregon Health Plan, for one thing, keeps going higher. Mm-hmm. We're going to have to cut back some of the coverage. Is the only way I can see we can control those costs. And secondly, when you get out in rural Oregon now, it's very difficult to get insurance coverage, period.
Mm-hmm.
And we've had companies leave the whole southern Oregon coast. I think we've only got one or two companies providing insurance down our whole population now. So it's, I don't know the answer, but I know that we've got a huge problem.
I know one of the answers for you guys is rural legislators. We'll talk about it one day.
Madam Chair, in terms of looking at homelessness, which is another issue that we report on, this is a homeless count.
we're just laughing because we know he's going to come in on that one.
Me. They're waiting for me to talk about this.
Madam Chair, thank you for giving me the warning. We've got numbers as recent as last year, and this is a shelter count plus that the Oregon Housing and Community Services Department does. And as you can see, the number of homeless has increased pretty dramatically since 1998. We hit a peak of over 9,000 in 1999. It dropped down to 8,000. These numbers, as you can also see, have some high variability. The department estimates that this is about a tenth of all Oregonians who are homeless at some time during the year. Senator Shields?
Yes, I've got to make a comment here. I've been not only running a shelter in my church during these census counts,
mm-hmm.
but I've gone out on teams of people. Like, I went out with the Sisters of the Road Cafe last year to count homeless
mm-hmm.
folks on that night.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason you can have a figure that goes from 7,098 to 9,299 back to 8,000 is literally the number of people you count that are homeless depend on the number of people you can get to show up and come out and do the work. Because
mm-hmm.
it's all a volunteer effort.
Mm-hmm.
And we were out in northwest Portland, kind of over toward the industrial area. And, you know, you're counting people in railroad yards. You know, you're sleeping.
Mm-hmm.
You're talking about people in doorways of warehouses. You're talking about people that are in tents up on the hillsides. And the instructions, at least, and I think these are standardized instructions, are, you know, I went to a little bit of training at Sisters of the Road. Well, the instructions are, you know, don't put yourself in danger, you know, climbing into the brush to invade a tent or something where you don't know whether there's two people or ten.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, how accurate these numbers are is really a difficult thing to deal with. But the purpose, and this, long before I was in the legislature, I was on the the Oregon Shelter Network is mm-hmm. what it was called. And it has a new name today. I don't know what it is. But we were the ones that came up with this idea, recognizing that how inaccurate it was, it still gave us some feel
right.
for the number of homeless.
Right.
And again, it's a photograph. It's here's how many people we could count on a given night that were homeless.
Yes, right. It is just a snapshot one night. It's a selective survey, but it's, if you do it the same way every year, you're going to get an idea of what the trend is, which is what we're looking for, not the absolute numbers at all.
Right.
Chair Fisher?
Yes, Senator Minister.
I'd like to spin this just a little bit different, and that is how we resolve this issue. I think the trend really shows we've got a huge problem.
Mm-hmm.
And the issue I'd like to point out is that, this is just my opinion, but I think we've got two different sets of problems. In the Portland area, you've got such a hot economy that people can't afford housing, and so they end up being homeless.
Right.
In the Bend area, you have such fast growth, they just can't build the houses fast enough. When you get to regions like where I live, the economy is so bad, we've got the houses, people just can't afford to live in them.
Wow.
And so, you know, when we look at low-cost housing, and the trend seems to be all we need to do is go out and build more houses or low-cost housing, that doesn't fit in every location is the point I'm trying to make. And I think in some cases, such as ours, maybe vouchers would really make a lot more sense. It doesn't do any good to build more homes if you've got vacant apartment houses. Right.
And another policy issue, if I could comment, Mr. Chair, is where we are spending our state dollars in terms of what level of low income as well. I mean, there is some low income housing, quote unquote, being built in some parts of Portland, which you know, you've got to earn a pretty good amount of money to even qualify to get into. So housing policy can affect these numbers somehow, depending upon where we're spending our very, very scarce state dollars.
What kind of determination are we making about homelessness? Is this willful homelessness, or is this any kind of homelessness, all kinds of homelessness? The reason I say that is a fellow I know did a master's degree, and they wanted him to do for his project and his thesis, they wanted him to do a deal on homelessness. And he spent a week in an area that was supposed to be targeted as an area of great homelessness. And he said he worked as hard as he could in a week's time. And he said he technically, as far as he was concerned, found only one person that was truly homeless. All the rest of them, for reasons of their own, had homes that they could go to, but were unwilling to go because they were not willing to adapt to maybe some standards of conduct and things like that, but the home was there and it was available to them, and they were making a choice that they just wouldn't do it. And I, in a way, I feel sorry for someone like that, but not terribly sorry, not sorry enough to start taking taxpayers' money and trying to make a cause celebre out of somebody that actually would have opportunity to have a home and to have someone to take care of them and to provide for them and that kind of thing if they were willing to accept it.
Mr. Chair, this survey, as I understand it, is simply people who are either sleeping outside on a certain night or who are in a shelter. Senator Shields helped invent this survey, so he knows more than I do about who's counted and who's not. So I would defer to him.
I would like to comment on what Senator Fisher has said. There are increasing numbers of mentally ill among the homeless. There are increasing numbers also of people that I think are Vietnam veterans, for instance, that may be suffering still from post-traumatic stress disorder or whatever, or maybe they're just alcoholic. I don't know what it is, but there are a good number of those folks that you might call volunteer homeless, but that does not negate the reality that there is an increasing demographic, and if there were some way to do it, it would be interesting to do this, where you separate homeless families with women and children from the more historic, traditional homeless males. Mm-hmm. You know, the what we like to call them ABODs, the able-bodied males, because that demographic has really exploded. This is anecdotal, but in the last year I spent 3 nights working in a shelter. And it was a small church shelter. It wasn't the one that I started at my own church years ago, but it was a different one. And there were 10 families during the 3 different nights. A night where each a month apart of the 10 families, only maybe 2 of them were two-parent families. Most of them were women and children, although there was one man with a couple children. And of that 10 families, I think about 7 or 8 of them actually had jobs. Mm. You know, they had a job, but today's minimum wage jobs, there's no way you're going to be able to afford an apartment in Portland. You know, so it's a difficult thing. Senator Fisher makes a good point, but there is still this demographic of homeless families, and that's why I started a family shelter, because mm-hmm. that's the most vulnerable of the populations,
right.
I think.
Right. I just as a personal comment, being somebody who grew up in the same house and slept in the same bed every night of my childhood, I just couldn't imagine, you know, being a child and not knowing where I was going to be sleeping the next day.
It's scary. I had a child, 2 children that came into the shelter at my church years ago, and as they came through the door, this is a 4-year-old and a 5-year-old, or maybe a 5 and 3-year-old. The little 5-year-old ran through the door of this little room. It was a Sunday school room. We'd put 5 bunk beds, so room for 10 people in this little crowded room. And as he ran through the door, he'd been out on the street, because we only ran it at night. You come in at 7 o'clock, you got to leave at 7 in the morning, you know. But I wasn't going on a guilt trip about not doing 24 hours a day. I wanted to do everything I could do. As he ran in the door of that little room, this 5-year-old kid said, "We're home." I mean, it was this joyous little, you can imagine a 5-year-old's voice. "We're home." You know, amazing. I can't imagine what it would be like.
Mr. Chair, I'll finish this up very quickly. I know I've gone over my 20 minutes just by a little bit.
None of that's due to our question.
In terms of court order child support, another one of the benchmarks that has to do with the health of families, we saw a dramatic increase when the legislature expanded the number of child support enforcement officers who were out there. We plateaued in 95. We've been pretty flat at about 70%, which puts us sort of in the middle of the pack vis-a-vis the rest of the country. And then just let me do the last 3 on independent living, if I might. The percentage of seniors who live independently, this is essentially all Oregonians over 65 not living in nursing homes. We're at about 98%. That number's increased as the years went from 96% to 98%. Now we're a little over that. 97% to 98%. That's a pretty high number for the rest of the country, as I understand it. In terms of Oregonians who have some kind of a lasting disability, we know that the poverty rate for those Oregonians is about twice as high as it is for the average Oregonian. It's at about 21%. And the unemployment rate for that same subset of the population is about twice what it is for Oregonians in general. In terms of our report card, just give you a quick review of what's going to happen when the report card comes out. Our grades generally in the social support area will improve. All of what we call the social support, the key benchmarks will be either the same or improved. A few of the others will be worse, but the grade overall will be an improvement over what it was in 1999. That concludes my remarks.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate taking the time here. And were we in a sub?
Oh.
Or did she go back to?
I think we went to make a public hearing.
Okay. I appreciate you coming.
My pleasure.
And there's a lot of food for thought in here and a lot of room for improvement.
Yes.
And yet there's some bright spots.
Yes, absolutely, Mr. Chair.
So I'm appreciative of those, and we'll get to working on the others.
Okay, thank you.
Close the public hearing, or the informational meeting, and adjourn the committee.
Jeff, are you looking at a...